Oh, it's the Jason holidays around here. A package arrived, and I'm extremely excited to work with it. This is the newest incarnation of the Applesauce floppy disk controller. And while I don't want to make it feel like an ad, I definitely want people to know what the current state of the art is in disk imaging, what I'm learning from it, and a little bit of historical context for why this is important to me. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Eric Vitello, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. If you haven't heard my other combination rants and raves about the Applesauce FDC, let me just quickly describe what this device is. Originally created to image Apple II disks, it's a hardware interface to an Apple floppy drive, removing the need for an Apple II, connecting it to a host computer, and letting you do an enormous amount of operations on an unsuspecting 140K Apple II floppy. Besides being able to see the sector layout, you can do full magnetic flux readings, analyze what's going wrong with them, designate something as being one format or another, and most importantly, creating open standard files that can be used by emulators and other utilities to bring these old programs and floppies back to life. I've talked about all the different things I've used them for, some of the operations I've done with Apple II floppies, and also that the Applesauce was going to get an upgrade. Finally, I got the newest version, which includes not just support for the Apple II, Commodore 64, and other 8-bit formats. It also contains support for IBM MFM drives. These are the drives and the floppies that went into everything from the IBM PC all the way up to modern Windows machines in the 1990s and even the 2000s. Because of the unquestioned dominance of DOS-based machines, these are the floppies and the drives that have the most population out there, the most examples. And if my storage was any indication, the one where I had the largest backlog that I was going to have to go through. By the time this machine has arrived, I have upwards of 5,000 floppies waiting for their opportunity to become disk images. To a limited and straightforward fashion, I've definitely been able to transfer some of them into disk images and put them up on the Internet Archive, even getting some of them into emulators and providing them to people instantly. But if there was anything wrong, if there was the slightest question as to what the disk sector quality was or what kind of disk format I was dealing with, well, I had to set it aside. This, along with a few other factors, made it so that I had decided to set aside the IBM DOS format until I could address it in bulk. Now that that day has arrived, I've made some additional discoveries about DOS formatted disks that, thankfully, I am nowhere near the first person to do so. Traipsing through websites, both active and incredibly inactive, I have found that there were multiple renaissances of people reading DOS disks and using various aftermarket DOS floppy drives to get the job done. There were discoveries made, exceptions noted, lots and lots and lots of research to determine what model floppy drives should be used and what pitfalls lay ahead as one started to move through all sorts of materials. You see, it's not just the fact that a disk can be read. If you're somebody who's in possession of, let's say, 20 or 30 floppy disks, disks that meant something to you when you were younger or that were passed over to you from a friend who knew you were into these kind of things, your problems are not major. You need help in getting the disks read, and after some efforts, you'll probably do fine. Coming up against thousands of disks from all sorts of sources, be they user groups, bulletin board sysops, and private collections of people who obsessively collected online files and put them onto floppies. It's a whole other ballgame. One of my major collections is the Wigglesworth collection, which is thousands of floppies, collected by a Mr. Wigglesworth who had passed on a number of years ago, and his son, looking to empty out his father's attic, had given me a call. Now, here I was, with a proper piece of equipment, and luckily for me, well over a dozen floppy drives to experiment with. Here's where things sound suspiciously like an infomercial for the applesauce. The work that John Morris did, making the applesauce function with Apple II drives, served him well in learning about the ups and downs of IBM MFM drives. You see, there's one drive in the PC-compatible market that stands head and shoulders above the others. The Teak GFR55 floppy drive. The Porsche, the Mercedes, the Rolls-Royce of DOS drives. Hundreds of thousands of these were manufactured throughout their heyday. And the combination of the build quality, the flexibility, and the ubiquitousness of these drives makes them perfect for the job of endless reading of ancient media. Knowing this, I had purchased a number of them through eBay or taken donations from other people, and I discovered, long after others had made similar discoveries, that there's no such thing as one canonical GFR drive. In fact, Teak, the manufacturer, subcontracted the work to so many factories that, in many cases, they implemented the spec with none of the same parts. So, what you ended up with was a drive that, if you had taken away the model number on the outside, would seem to be completely different. Some circuit boards are tiny, other ones expand all along the top and are the size of a floppy disk themselves. The jumpers, where you move small pieces of metal to make connections and configure the drive, are all over the place. Sure, they're labeled with the same letters so that you know that jumpers with names like D0 and IS do what they do, but they are everywhere on the board. Each one is an almost unique adventure. Of the 12 drives I own, only 3 of them have the same layout. This tells me that the chances of getting things wrong were legion. Luckily for me, a very dedicated and thoughtful group of people in the late 2000s had gone through and documented many of the aspects of these drives. Reading online, it seems very much that a group of classic PC enthusiasts wrote utilities and diagrams and documentation to try to get over this mass of difference yet similarity with the drives. They document what each and every jumper does, how they're laid out, the best settings you need to do, along with utilities for tuning them, making sure the speed is right, and understanding every single aspect of these rapidly decaying and out-of-fashion drives. So, when I wandered in, 10 years later, with my own needs, the path had not just been broken, but it had been paved and given guardrails and signposts. I thank all of those people. They turned what could have been multiple months of effort into a light jog of a few hours. PC disks range wildly in capacity, 180K, 360K, 720K, 1.2 megabytes, 1.4 megabytes, all depending on configuration, machinery, and form factor. Understanding what disk you have in the drive would normally be really involved, but the applesauce does a whole range of analysis while it's doing its work to figure out what the format is, what speed the drive needs to be running at, and what exactly the drive has. Not only does it figure out where the sectors are and allow you to do all sorts of rereads to make sure you got the data, It also analyzes the directory structure of the files to tell you which ones are complete and copied and which ones are corrupted or have issues. This comes into play all the time when a floppy has damage on it, either magnetic rot or actual physical damage. And being able to have the software analyze it and tell you all the files are intact, even though all of the reading wasn't successful, is priceless beyond measure. If everything works right, and it doesn't always work right, you can read a disk in seconds, label it for what it is, and then set it aside. The most important part of this whole process isn't so much whether or not you can read a disk. It's how you can come up with a workflow that'll work through 5,000 disks. Setting aside ones that are irretrievable to look at later, coming up with a system for unique names and file names, making sure that you can find what you did before and that you properly label what you've got, well, it's almost like it's a full-time job, which it is for many, many people. The great unsung heroism that exists in going through older data, collections of books and movie film reels, and going through all sorts of items, physical and digital, is an art, a science, and an occupation far beyond what I'm doing. I wade into this pool when I need to, but I move out of it quickly, because my area of expertise is moving around large amounts of digital files in a way that people can find what they need, or which I can help people find by giving them simple documentation or signposts on what to do next. When you plug a new floppy drive into the applesauce, it now analyzes the drive, running against a scratch disk and figuring out all of the elements that it can via software, saving you incredible amounts of time understanding the capabilities of the drive you have, plus diagnosing its speed and power setup and whether it's doing everything it's supposed to. As a result, multiple drives that I had in my collection turned out to have damage. Heads that didn't work, power that wasn't working correctly, data that wasn't being transferred. So I knew from the outset where the problems might be. And then, when reading a floppy, knowing it's probably the floppy. As of now, I'm hundreds of floppy disks into this process. I'm reading everything that was in the stacks and stacks of floppies that were given to me by the Wigglesworth family. Boxes of utilities and BBS capture files, shareware programs and commercial disks, pieces of the history of someone who spent years collecting them. Their objective value, well, that's not my debate. My process is to be there when these items needed to make the transition, this beautiful transition from small ones and zeros magnetically encoded on a plastic disk into files traveling a worldwide network and coming up against people fascinated by the history that came before and able to write scripts and processing that tell them much more than I would ever be able to tell by a glance. That role works for me, a smiling translation and transmission machine, a cog inside of a gearbox that I have no idea will ever be hooked up to anything. But I hope, here and there, we'll pause for a moment to thank me, and more importantly, the people who came before me, to make this piece of history come alive again. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bigquianu, Mark Pilgrim, Peter Healy, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Manxalot, Sean Kelly, John Sturm, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. John Morris, Disk Blitz, lives in Hawaii now, working on applesauce floppies in between his day job, creating these special tools, and dedicating himself to making sure that the most important component, the software that drives it, is as complete and flexible as possible. I truly believe, and this is an easy prediction because I'm seeing it come true every year, that software that drives the hardware that evaluates the past is where all of the real work lays ahead. We are becoming exceedingly good at pulling in all sorts of digital versions of analog, magnetic, and physical items. And it's only on the software level, helping us make decisions we need to and quickly doing evaluations that would take us months to do, that we will see the real innovation coming forward. I'm excited for a world where full sentence parsing allows you to find exactly the file, exactly the aspect of something from the digital past, and bring it right to the forefront for research, for information, for entertainment, for enjoyment, for wonder.